Okay, and now we start the earnest, and our first speaker is Adam Burrows from Princeton University. Adam.
Thank you, Ilan. I'm going to try to summarize, as I see it, some of the highlights of theory. Theory is imperfect. The comparison with observation has been fruitful, but also imperfect. I also think that so far the conference has been far too much sweetness and light. So, that's right. Okay. And I want to thank my collaborators who aren't responsible for what's about to happen. I'm going to talk a little bit about transits and the radius mass relation, and then I'm going to jump into the wavelength dependence of the transit radius, so-called transmission spectroscopy. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about secondary eclipse spectra, and you can imagine I'll have to go fairly fast, a little bit about albedos. And I want to end up with planetary phase light curves, photometric light curves, some recent results, and some brightness and thermal composition maps of 3D models, and what to give you a picture of what these things might look like. The mass radius relation, as Tristan so ably summarized, is problematic. But we think we can understand a fair amount of it, particularly at low entropies. But the important thing to emphasize is that it depends on the age. The age is problematic. It depends on the star and the semi-major axis distance. You have to get the irradiation right. It depends on whether there's a core mass, the planet mass, the atmospheric opacities, and those can be directly connected to metallicity, or they could be a little bit different, but certainly connected to metallicity. So there are a number of different things that have to be employed in a custom fit to any particular object, and you can't, one size does not fit all. So custom fits to these radius mass relations are crucial. We've seen this before. The scatter in the radii has been quite exciting, in fact. And it's certainly true that these larger radii aren't explained by canonical models. And people have discussed that a lot. I'm not going to go into any great detail. WASP-12b and TRES-4 being the most problematic. As Tristan mentioned yesterday, there are at least two radius anomalies. The canonical one, the standard one, is that some of the radii are too large to fit some simple theories. But it's also the case that a number of them are small. And the best fit, as far as I can tell, and I think Tristan agrees in broad outline, is that they're signatures of cores, or high metallicity, or high element abundances, high mean molecular weights in these. And that's quite interesting. I don't look at the details of this. This is just radius versus age for a representative model for HG2 and M458b, and just look at these three curves. This shows the dependence on the opacities. And here is the range of observations for HD209. And you can see that to within the error bars or so, you go to about 3 times solar atmospheric abundances, and it's not so difficult to fit HD209. And one of the reasons it's easier to fit now is the Torres et al. Age, again, the wide error bars, but it's now about 3.2 as opposed to 5.5 gigayears. And so there are a number of these objects, I think, that are within spitting distance of theory. Now, what I said before was there are a number of objects that aren't unless you have cores. If you just take the data for a number of these objects, these are just representative, and you do some basic theory, you can see the evolution of the radius flattening out to the cone configuration, but you need the age in there. And the theory generally is too high, not too low. And one of the ways of explaining this, and Tristan has also discussed this, is to include heavy elements. You can parameterize this in various ways. For each of these objects, these are 12 representative objects, and if you add more, it still follows the basic trend. For the given distance, for the given star, for the given approximate age, notice I haven't put any error bars on there, it would be very, very messy. You can do the calculation of what core mass would give you the best fit, so you make that a free parameter. And we plot it arbitrarily versus stellar metallicity, or a putative stellar metallicity. And what you get is a trend, where at low stellar metallicities, the core mass you need to fit is fairly small. You don't get very large core masses at this low stellar metallicity. And at high stellar metallicities, the core mass you would need to fit is fairly large, going up to 100 Earth masses, which is quite large, and particularly for OGO 120, 132b. there were objects, let's say this hat P1, that didn't fit this at all in the first observations, but they actually are starting to fit a little bit better. There's a lot of noise in this. And so all I'm doing is suggesting a trend, that there is a trend with inferred, between inferred core mass and stellar metallicity. And stellar metallicity was not employed in the modeling. So this may suggest something about their origin. There's a little confusion. I just wanted to clarify. For getting the larger objects, you need to deposit heat in the core, and the atmosphere won't do much good. It's just going to be re-radiated. But you don't need much. And this is just the amount of heat you might need to get a certain radius increase, increasing the amount of power deposited on the abscissa here. It's only about part in 10 to the 4, part in 10 to the 3, part in 10 to the 2, in order to get significant radius boost for different mass objects, et cetera, at different distances. You don't have, it's only a small fraction of the stellar insulation power that is necessary if you can get that into the core. And a variety of solutions have been discussed. Transmission spectroscopy, in quotes, is something that people have pursued, and we had a nice talk from Giovanna discussing that, at least in preliminary fashion. This pioneering work, of course, was the first detection of a composition at all, of any sort, in an exoplanet by Charbonneau et al. And that was a 4-sigma result at sodium D. But we'd like to be able to do this as a function of wavelength, because the apparent size, of course, is a function of the opacities. You're looking higher in the atmosphere if the opacity is large, lower in the atmosphere if it's small. And the variation in with wavelength of the apparent size of the planet is an ersatz for a spectrum. And it's fairly weakly dependent on temperature pressure profiles, but depends pretty directly on composition. This is an example from a paper we did at 14 et al, 2003, just to show you the basic variations, water being one of the most important things. This, now I'm going to continue with this. This is a map of the temperature distribution that we gave to Emily Rauscher and Kristin Manu to do their 3D simulations of the temperature that we would get on the day side and the night side with the scale height exaggerated by a factor of 10, just to show this is irradiated, this is not. And then when you turn on the dynamics, you get something like this, where you redistribute the heat. You get these different pressure levels. You can see the velocities. But the transit cord, relevantly, cuts through something like this, and you see more the day side than the night side. This is, again, exaggerated, but you have to calculate the path through there in order to get this transmission spectroscopy. If you do the same sort of thing with different types of opacities in the atmosphere, for example, with and without an extra optical absorber in the upper atmosphere, you get different types of redistribution. Just to remind you, this has a bigger bulge here with the upper atmosphere absorber, and this doesn't. But this just gives you a sense of what the these models look like. This is temperature at two different levels with velocity vectors. And you can see very clearly the contrast between day and night for the 3D models from post-processed by us from Emily and Kristin. Now, when you transit, when you go into transit, the effective area that you get increases due to that extra outer shell that Giovanna talked about as you enter at ingress and then at egress. And this just shows the type of wavelength dependence of that fractional correction. One micron, 10 microns, and you can see there are lots of interesting features in principle. This is just generic. This is not anything in detail. It's some sort of model for HD209458b, but just shows you that going into transit, staying in transit, and going out. And then if you do these types of calculations, normalizing to the measured radius in the optical at 1.32 Jupiter radii, for HD209458b, you can see what the predictions for without an extra absorber here for the upper atmosphere with an extra absorber might be, and compared to the observations by Beaulieu in particular, and you see the models don't fit very well. We're still in an early stage of trying to get this stuff to work, but you can see the promise of data like this when we can get reasonable theory. But right now, we can get close, but by and large, things are not that good. And the similar conclusions were arrived at in a nice paper by Fortney et al. Recently. Now I get to secondary eclipses, so-called hot Jupiter spectra. We've talked a lot about this, and it was emphasized earlier in the meeting A lot of the flux, this is lambda F lambda coming off of a planet, for example, just TRES-1 in theory, and much of the flux is coming out in the JH and K bands, where NICMOS may be interesting and other platforms may be interesting. But Spitzer is looking at just about 35% to 10% of the flux. And so that's just the tail. And this is should be something that people keep in mind as they study these objects. Now, what we had expected for planet-star contrast ratios, by and large, is represented by this TRES planet-star flux ratio spectrum. Here's 10 microns. These are data from Charbonneau et al., 2005, just IREX 2 and 4. But this sharp drop is just what we might have expected because of the water absorption, a little bit of CO absorption there as well. Okay. Now, this is what we see for HD 189733b. This has been shown before. There are a number of interesting features here, one of which is that IRAC 1 and IRAC 2 have this ratio that's a greater than 1. 1 to 2 is greater than 1. And this is actually probing certain regions of the atmosphere that can tell you what the relative temperature profile is in principle. Now, there's also the composition. But you'd have to change the composition by a lot, the CO, for example, in order to change this. So I think that this is actually a measure of the temperature profile, perhaps a local inversion there. You also see in the IRS spectra of Grillmer et al. A little bit of a bump there. It's not huge, but it's a 3 sigma bump, and it's exactly where you would expect the water feature to be, at 6.2 microns. That little gap right there is just what you'd expect there. And hopefully we can get better data on this someday. Certainly with JWST. So this also, with this ratio here, and the fact that this is a little bit low and also showing water, doesn't show anything really exotic. However, HD 209458b does. These are data from Knudsen et al., some very crude fits that we put together. And you see differences between this and HD 209458b. In particular, IRAC 1 is much lower than IRAC 2. It flipped. And that is a crude indication of, in my estimation, of inversions in the atmosphere. So we might be getting some handle, at least, on the temperature gradients. The other thing is this very large bump. The canonical model without any extra absorber in the atmosphere, in the optical, would be way down here. And you could move it around a little bit. But this is a factor of 3. Now, there are error bars here as well. But this bump also suggests, if in fact it is a bump and not just a straight line through here, suggests it's in water and emission. This is one of the first things that suggested that we may be getting some handle on a very hot atmosphere. You also see this with XO1. This is rather problematic because it has a rather low irradiation. It's the same as HD 189, but it shows very different behavior. So we're just in the preliminary stages of trying to explain this. But this also shows a signature, in principle, of a hot upper atmosphere to get this high fluxes and perhaps an inversion. These are the types of temperature profiles, and I just want to call your attention to the fact that the IRAC formation areas, and you can do contribution functions, but this is sort of the median points, are paced like this. And see, IRAC 1 is deeper, IRAC 2 is at altitude, and so the relative flux of those can tell you something about the temperatures. And MIPS 24 microns and IRAC 3 and 4 are shown here for this particular model for TRES-1. Notice IRAC 3 and 4 are frequently close, and so the fact that those two fluxes can be fairly different is hard to fit. Now, a lot of the suggestions for whether there was an inversion or a bifurcation in solution was given by Hubinen et al., where these are exactly the same temperature models, but you get flipped absorptions into emissions if you get absorption in the upper atmosphere. And this was just naturally done in these models by assuming that titanium oxide was still in chemical equilibrium at altitude, which, as many people know, I don't think can be the case because of the cold trap effect. There are many cold traps, but that remains to be seen. And so you can get temperature profiles not like that black curve. Well, you can get little divots in here because of redistribution, et cetera, but you get a jump from here to here. That might be necessary in order to explain these hot upper atmospheres. And you see a slope right here that could be all sorts of, this is qualitatively reasonable to explain this type of behavior. Now, we could put TiO in the atmospheres, and this is from Spiegel et al. With and without TiO, temperature profiles, these are the same scales, are very different. You see the purple curve, it's just going down here. It's purple curve for WASP-12b. The temperature difference is 1500 Kelvin. You can't do that, well, I don't think you can do that dynamically, but I think I need to keep an open mind, and we all do, just as James Cho indicated, that maybe there are dynamical processes that can be heating the upper atmosphere, but they have to be very efficient, and a lot of power has to be going into them. But you see the big difference. It's this big temperature here that is indicated by the data. And what the slopes are in here still remains to be seen, but this could give you inversions. And you can get corresponding spectra that are fairly different, that are fairly interesting as well, just with the TiO hypothesis. So inversions seem to be indicated by these IRAC2 to IRAC1 ratios, maybe other things, and also this high bump that might be water and emission. But a hot upper atmosphere, I think, is a much more solid conclusion, much hotter, at least 1,000 Kelvin for most of these objects for which such inversions have been identified. It's very hard to get to this otherwise, unless you put something like TiO or some other absorber at altitude. If you don't have either one of them, you just can't fit it, I think. So the question is, what is absorbing at altitude? Well, we did some calculations of what type of mixing might be necessary to overcome this cold trap, and these are diffusion coefficients. The conclusion was it might be very difficult. You're going to have a very vigorously mixed atmosphere from the bottom at bar and higher pressures to the top at millibar pressures. That may be possible, but I think that's what would be necessary to get TiO. But there's a way of checking this, of course, which is to look at the spectra. There was preliminary data from Desar et al. Where they thought they did not see TiO, at least in solar abundances, but we don't know that yet. And so this is really would be the smoking gun. If you have detailed information of what in the optical is absorbing, if there is anything, then we should see that. If there isn't anything and you see a hot upper atmosphere, it may be mechanical. And there are lots of ideas. Don't look at this in any detail about what it could be. There's some interesting suggestions by Kevin Zonley and collaborators, but we just don't know what it could be. And I think people should keep an open mind on this. Now, albedos, of course, have been the subject of this discipline for many, many years, and people have been trying to look for the optical reflection off planets. This is very difficult, but in the age of Corot and Most and Kepler, we should be able to get quite a number of optical planet-star flux ratios and inferred albedos. The reason this is difficult, this is 10 microns, is that the planet-star flux ratios can be large at 10 microns, but very, very small in principle at below 1 micron. 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 5, maybe 10 to the minus 4 are what you might expect. And we do have some data. Most pioneered this with a good upper limit for HD209 458b, but we also have data on Corot 1 and 2, and of course, the wonderful data that is just the tip of the iceberg from Kepler on HAT-P7b. And you see the types of ratios. People are getting 10 to the minus 4, fairly high numbers. For HD209 458b, though, the upper limit is fairly low, and you get 10 to the minus 5. These albedos are going to be fairly small, less than 10%, at least is the prediction we would have and we've actually made for many, many years. But we'll see what actually is the case. And of course, these data for Corot in the optical compare the near-infrared and the far-infrared, and there's a lot to be said about that, but I just want to show some data here for Corot 1. The theories don't fit perfectly across here, but you can by and large explain qualitatively, certainly and almost quantitatively, a range of frequencies. And you see this also for Corot too. Here's the optical data, here's infrared, but a variety of models, even black body models, can in principle fit. So we're just in the beginning stages. Now phase light curves have exercised people for a while. This is Upsilon Andromeda B at 24 microns, very nice data from Harrington et al. But the interpretation is a little confused because, of course, we don't have an inclination, we don't have a mass for this object. And you can put together models for this. This object is fairly irradiated, and if it has an inversion, it's very easy to fit. Here are example light curves with various radii, various and a given inclination that can fit fairly nicely. There are too many models that can fit, in fact, and they can fit without a cold night side. And you can do the same thing for HD 179 and 949. Various models will fit that as well, but too many models perhaps. And so we really do need to get better data. These data, of course, are just representative from Knudsen et al. Of wonderful phase light curves. Unfortunately, they weren't complete, but they were very, very good. And you can see that while we can fit the secondary eclipse, the shapes are starting to deviate. And if these data were true, then we couldn't explain this. And this is the origin of where the hotspot, the idea that the hot spot and the cold spot could be on the same side. However, recent reanalysis of this, particularly Eric Egal, has called into question these data, but it's still going to be problematic to fit this. I think this is going to be an open question, but it's going to be easier if these points aren't there. Okay, so light curves are rather crucial in all this. And these are example light curves where we took some Rauscher and Manu models, 3D models, and then we just calculated what the light curves would be at different phases. These are just the planet-star flux ratios that you would expect at different phases. Just look at the red. The blue is what we would get with a 1D model at secondary eclipse without an extra absorber. And you see the variation. When you don't have the extra absorber, the variation is small. But you can't fit these data at all here in the IRAC bands. If you have the extra absorber, you get this variation here. It's a bit larger, it could be about 50%. This fit has its problems, but at least it gets closer. And these are the types of behaviors. And this is what you'd expect as a function of phase. And you can see there are wavelength dependencies as you go around. The colors are changing in the infrared. You can do this in the optical as well. And you can see the type of variation. This is just representative of the type of thing that theorists should provide and observers should look at to try to compare with observations. And these are available to anybody who wants. This is the type of map that you would get for these types of models. This is just rotating. The black line is the terminator. This includes the redistribution due to the zonal flows. And these are just, this is a J-band map of the surface of this particular model. And if you saw in the beginning, there's a hotspot that's displaced at secondary eclipse or at zero phase. You can do the same thing for another model without any extra absorber. There are differences, and there are differences in the advection. This is just a particular, this is actually the brightness and includes limb darkening, any slant angle effects. You could also do the same sort of thing for IRAC 3 or the IRAC bands, and you noticed, and it'll come around again, that in this case the hotspot wasn't displaced much. This is an important result, is that if you look in different bands, you're seeing different levels, and the displacement of the hotspot is different. And so you can, in principle, by looking at different bands, actually measure, well, approximately, it's going to be rather crude, but you get a handle on the variation in the zonal flows at depth and the temperatures at depth. And so you can actually do probing by looking at various bands. You can actually probe the vertical extent, the profiles. This is the same sort of thing in the I band. You see how dark it is in the I band on the night side. And this is what the observer should look at, which is the integrate. You integrate over those disks, and you get the magnitude excess from the minimum. So this is bright, and this is dim, so it's backwards magnitudes. For R, I, R, all the IRAC, J, H, and K. And you see from zero phase, there are shifts. Very little shifts in the IRAC bands, although they can be 10 to 20 degrees. But in J, H, and K, particularly J, at shorter wavelengths, you get significant shifts that can be 45 degrees or more. And these are just representative of what one can do. It's not the be-all and end-all for HD2 and 948B. Now, these are the types of maps you would get for the same models for methane if it's in equilibrium, which it may not be, of course, as we heard. It's very possible to be out of equilibrium, it's not known in detail, and I would be surprised if it's way out of equilibrium, although CO should be out of equilibrium at altitude. But you can see the types of maps. The blue and green are lots of methane. That's the terminator, and the lighter colors would be CO. So we can explore these models and explore the predictions by using these approaches. I would love to be able to talk about planet-star contrast ratios. I'm not going to do that. We had a wonderful set of presentations for the ground and space yesterday. These are contrast ratios for wide separations, and these are just models. And the important thing to note is that different combinations of mass and age are differently accessible to these different cameras. And it would be wonderful to be able to get high contrast and mid-infrared, which is going to be very difficult. But here's a putative GPI capability, and you just move these models over, because the distance from the star is fairly large, to see what you can see. A 5 Jupiter mass object at 1 giga year, 1 Jupiter mass object at 300 mega years, things like that. That's what we really want to get. And that would be interesting. And of course, not for high contrast imaging, in principle, except for the very closest ones and secondary eclipse observations, will JWST be a fabulous platform. And we've heard a little bit about this, and we'll hear a little bit more later, but I think we're all anticipating what JWST will be able to do. And so I want to end by just listing some of the basic techniques that have really energized this field. I'm amazed at the growth over the years of not only the number of people working in this, but the number of papers and the number of results that are coming out. And we're all, I think, rather excited about all this. The future is going to be incredible in this, if past is prelude. These platforms and approaches from the ground and space are going to lead, and there are going to be other ideas and other creative approaches that people have no doubt haven't even discussed or are just now discussing that may actually push the direction of this field. And so theory is, I think, well posed to try to support this effort in a broad range of fronts. And I thank you for your patience.
OK, questions, comments? OK,
yeah. Nick Cowan, you mentioned that the IRAC channel's three and four that are almost the same pressure? They're proving the same pressure? Am I remembering that
approximately
properly?
That was for that model, yeah. And generally, they're a little bit closer than I would like.
Okay. And is that sufficiently generic that you could use the difference in observed flux in those two to try and constrain systematic issues with models and or observations?
I'll get you a range. They're closer than I would like. They're closer than IRAX 1 and 2. But there is a bit of a range. And for those models, for HD2 and FFDAB, for example, they were unhealthily close. And so it's hard to break that. And it's been the hardest part to fit. But I'll get you better numbers.
Travis Barman here. Hi, Adam. Nice talk. So in the spirit of confrontation, which seemed to be what you were aiming for at the beginning, I completely disagree with everything you just said. No, but seriously. So
you completely agree with everything I said?
No, not quite. So my question is, when you introduce things like this extra unknown absorber,
right,
and also a throttle on the temperature structure, this P sub N that can regulate,
right,
the temperature structure, are you concerned that you're losing any predictive power you might have in your atmosphere model when you suddenly have complete freedom over your opacities and your temperature structure?
It's not complete freedom, but you're right. I take a page out of Dave Stevenson's book. These aren't stars. These are planets, and planets have character. And so things are complicated. And so we know that there's going to be redistribution at depth. We know there's going to be redistribution at depth, and that's a way of trying to handle it. We don't know how the night side is going to look, and so we would like to be able to make predictions for that, and if you don't have some redistribution at all, you're not going to be able to really predict it. But you're quite right that with the extra absorber, we're just sort of going to the unknown. It seems to be indicated. If you just left the TIO in there, and as I showed, we have done that on occasion, you will have an extra absorber at altitude. What's necessary is something like TIO at solar abundances, which is a very strong absorber. But if you have it at altitude and there's a cold trap effect, which for most of these models I think there is, then the TIO is going to settle into that region. It's going to condense out, and it has to be lofted back up. And it has to be lofted back up to the same abundance, which happened to be at solar. And I think that that's hard, but it's not impossible. We'll see with the much more detailed optical spectrum. You'll have to see TIO. If you don't, and you see something else, that would be exciting as well. If you don't, and you don't see anything else, and then I think the mechanical mechanisms might be more viable. But even those, again, you have to absorb for the other people in the audience, you have to absorb a fair fraction of all the flux coming in at altitude in order to explain the mid-infrared flux, which is how it's re-radiated. So I'm concerned to some degree, but I'm comfortable with the fact that we're going to have to make a little bit more Baroque models given the character of these irradiated, rotating, differentially rotating objects. It doesn't sound as though it's on.
Now it's green. Okay. Jeremy Goodman, Princeton. It would be helpful for those of us who'd like to think about other heating sources if you would plot not just the temperature, but the divergence of the infrared flux or something like that, so that we know how much energy is required at what altitude.
Yeah,
and
I know.
It's
there's
difficult
so much
to do that without having access to the line lists and all that.
So. Yeah. No. I think that's going to be very, very useful. And also looking at 3D models, people who are doing 3D models should also calculate the divergence of the vertical fluxes and make them available normally, because the fluxes in the horizontal direction are mostly advective. And it would be nice to see, even though the sum is going to be approximately zero, it'll be nice to see what the different contributions are. So just adding to what you said, I agree. It's not on.
Hello? Okay. You raised the issue of methane and whether it's in chemical equilibrium or not. Curtis Cooper and I showed in 2006 that it's almost certainly not going to be, because the conversion time between CO and methane is many orders of magnitude longer than plausible dynamical times at all observable pressures. So models that assume equilibrium are not going to be right. You know, so in those models, it would be pretty much equilibrated. And it could be that photochemistry would lead to some sort of perturbation on that, but I don't think it's going to lead to giant day-night differences. That's one point. Another point related to following up on what Travis mentioned. So I think in your models, the PN factor is mostly confined between two pressures. And that's not generally what the dynamical models do. They do sort of advection over a full range all the way up to the top of the atmosphere. So it'd be interesting to know sort of how your models would respond to that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There is going to be a region that that dominates in the redistribution. One parameter isn't going to fit it, so you have to do the multi-D models, and I agree with that. This is just our attempt to do better than the cruder 1D models. We have to say something about that, but eventually we're going to have to do a much, much better job. And the methane, yes, we see this in brown dwarfs. You see this in Jupiter, where there's an excess of CO. It's very clear, and we've calculated as Yvonne and I, and also Didier Simon, have calculated in the brown dwarf case, in the Y dwarf cases as well, and I think that's going to be an important issue. But nobody's really including that anyway now, so that's going to have to be done with a number of chemical species.
James Graham, you showed briefly your predictions for isolated Jupiter planets, giga-year-old 5 Jupiter mass. Can I ask you what your current thinking is about clouds and prediction of clouds and objects near condensation boundaries?
What we're going to do is provide a range of cloud models with different particle sizes and extents, because I don't think that we have a good constraints on the meteorology. I think that we're going to have to let the observers tell us what models fit best collectively, not for any one object, because you'll probably have too many degrees of freedom. But if we get a variety of these objects, for example, WISE finds a number of objects and there's a lot of follow-up down to 300 Kelvin or 400 Kelvin effective temperatures, where you would expect water clouds in the atmosphere, then we may be able to constrain or at least limit the range of model parameters. But I wouldn't trust any theoretical models purporting to explain the particle size distribution, the distributions with altitude, etc., patchiness, anything like that at this stage. So we're going to provide models that will sort of hopefully bracket the possibilities and give you some sense, but I don't think, as I say, we'll provide them, and we hope the observers will actually constrain the theorists' enthusiasms.
Thanks, Adam.
This one? Hi. Morning, Adam. It's James. Some of the dynamics calculations you're showing looks like they're fraught with artificial small-scale noise. Do you have a sense for how much you can trust these calculations?
Oh, they can be trusted too. It's a loaded question.
you asked for a controversial.
That's true. That's true. Maybe I should put my coat back.
Yeah.
I think that all the 3D models, and the 3D modelers can chime in here, are limited. I'm just showing a representative sample from Columbia. I think that they're as good as any, and they may want to address these issues. But I think if you look in the literature, none of the 3D models fits any better than the 1D models. But they have for many of the observables. However, they have the potential to do far better, and that's the way to go. So I wouldn't really focus too much on the details of any particular model, because I think that they're going to be limited, significantly limited, and the techniques have to be improved, et cetera. But there will be data that will require three-dimensional insight, and so I just encourage the modelers, but I wouldn't expect that the current generation of multi-D models are going to survive. I can't say much more, and perhaps people in the audience would like to chime in on that.
Well, yeah, so I think there are some issues. There are several issues, so it's a long discussion. It's loaded, as Adam said. One of the issues is this business of hydraulic jump that was identified by Adam in his simulations. There are shock-like features in some of these simulations, and we're not quite sure we're dealing with that properly. So, you know, there are real physical issues. And there might be issues with noise, boundary conditions. Yeah, so it's a little bit involved.
But there's also the chemistry and the opacities and this sort of thing. I think that that's going to be a major issue as well. These are strongly rated atmospheres are probably quite exotic in their compositions, at least some aspects of them, and those may be important. For example, the extra absorber that I keep referring to may actually require this type of photolysis, and we don't know what the species is.
More questions, comments? Adam.
This is maybe a question both for James and or you. As far as the idea of creating inversions through wave heating, it's, I think, a cool idea. I sort of like it. But you want to also raise the infrared photosphere into that inversion so that you at the appropriate wavelength so that you can get the spike in the appropriate IRAC band. So if you only have the inversion, but you leave the all of the opacities alone, it's a generic sort of case that would not produce an inversion in radiative equilibrium, then that would not necessarily have an IRAC spectrum that would look like it has an inversion, because the inversion is at pressures that are too low.
I'm not sure I agree with that. I think the position in the pressure space where the photospheres are in the mid-infrared, the IRAC bands, doesn't move much from with an extra absorber and not between those two models. So you basically need just to heat that atmosphere, and I think that solves the problem to zeroth order.
Let me give you an example. So on Jupiter, for example, has a thermosphere that goes up to 1,000 K, and that's not visible in low resolution infrared spectra.
Well, of course.
Right?
But
so you need to have the inversion.
It's at nanobar pressures, pressures, and there's no optical depth there for these photons.
Exactly. So that's an extreme case, but even if it's a couple scale heights too high, then you're not going to get enough flux.
It's not a couple of scale heights. It's you need to get the temperatures up between a tenth of a bar and millibars, and not at microbars or at nanobars. And I think that's where you not only have the infrared, the IRAC photospheres, that's where you need the heat, and that's where I think as long as you raise the temperature, you'll be able to approximately fit those data.
So at our 3D models, for example, we tried some where we put in an absorber. It was representing TIO, but it really could be any, representing any sort of a visible wavelength absorber. So we could get an inversion with no problem, but it doesn't have the right properties to explain the IRAC data for 209458B, for example. And the problem is that the condition necessary for getting an inversion, as Tristan discussed yesterday, and it can be shown in analytical models, is that the infrared opacity has to be much less than the visible opacity if you're doing it with a radiative.
I know, that's what we published in 2003.
That's right, yeah. And so in our particular models, even though we had a great inversion, it went up to 2,000 Kelvin, but the infrared photosphere at that IRAC band was still at the base of the inversion. So the brightness temperature at that one band was still not reflecting what was the high temperatures that were in the inversion itself. So we're sort of wasting the inversion in a sense. And that problem could also happen, like I said, with these dynamic.
Remember, there are two things. One is heating the upper atmosphere, which is the most crucial thing. And then there's the temperature gradients, which will be associated with the inversion. And it's possible that the IRAC 1 and IRAC 4 may be really hard to fit, but you'll at least get the level higher. So the higher temperature, I think, is crucial. And I sort of disagree with the sense of your comment, but I agree with the details. In the sense that it's hard to fit exactly those features. But you'll still be off by a factor of 3 if you don't heat in this region. We always are able to do that with you know.
Nico Madhu here. So you mentioned the difference between the IRAC 3.6 and 4.5 microns as evidence for or suggestive of inversions.
Suggestions, right, yeah.
But we know that for all the planets that have 4 IRAC points, more than half, which have that property, can be explained without any thermal inversions.
Well, I think that they're explained if you change the compositions by at least a factor of 100 CO, for example.
With equilibrium compositions.
No, I don't agree with that. Okay. I think that if you have equilibrium compositions and you're conserving energy, you have radiative equilibrium atmospheres, then that's what you get. But let's talk about it offline.
Yeah, I mean, I'll invite you to see our paper, which will come in like 2 months, showing exactly equilibrium compositions and all sorts of temperature profiles.
What I will say, though, is it's you need an extra optical absorber at altitude to get the temperatures to get anywhere near the results. And that's I'll bet anybody a $100 bottle of wine on that. The inversions, that's the more subtle thing. No, it's a more subtle thing, but I'll take it. And that's what we're going to work through. And the models really need some help, but you have to at least have the constraint of energy conservation, and you don't want to change the compositions hugely. Remember, these are saturated features. You have to change them by a lot. I believe it.
Yeah, let me make a comment too. Yeah, I take my privilege to be chairman. So in the 2003 paper, we showed not only the inversion can exist, but with the same composition, with same everything, there are two legitimate solutions. So with the same composition, you either can have inversion or you don't have to have inversion. There are two completely legitimate solutions which do satisfy energy balance. Yeah. Moreover, that's only for certain, say, range of distances. For distances very, very close, like OGLTR56B, you are sort of stuck with this high temperature solution and low temperature doesn't exist. But for some range, both solutions exist, and for other distances, only low temperature solution exists. So, there is a lot of space, and now it was only for the case of TIO itself. Now, if you have a freedom and you involve this other additional absorber, so one can still construct self-consistent models, only assuming that you have this putative extra absorber. Okay, Travis. You don't agree, yeah?
Just to follow up on Ivan's comment about the two legitimate solutions, that's highly dependent on the opacities. As you showed in your paper, this is dependent on the atmosphere opacities, and whether or not you cross multiple solutions is dependent on the opacities. So it's possible that you might have a single solution if the opacities are quite different.
Yeah. So I guess I had one.
You only need are two conditions. You need opacity being in maximum of incoming radiation, in optical. And it is temperature sensitive, that's all. Then you can get some sort of inversion as well as bifurcation. Okay, last question here.
Actually, just a last comment. So in the interest of sparking more debate on the 209458 models, the error bars for those points are going to get a factor of 2 to 3 smaller with new data. So there'll be much tighter constraints on the models from those.
Great. Thanks.
Okay, so let's thank our speaker again. Next speaker is Adam Bugasser, and he will talk about Van't Hoff exoplanet connection.